Right now, yesterday's school shooting in Cleveland. Asa Kuhn is the 14-year-old student who shot two teachers and two students at his high school before turning the gun on himself. It's the latest shooting in the wake of Virginia Tech, Columbine, Paducah, and too many other examples of school violence. Naturally, there are fresh questions about how schools prepare and how effective their preparations are. If you're a teacher, administrator, or a student, what does your school do to plan for this kind of event? What's involved? Are there safety drills? Is there stepped-up security? And do you think these plans are effective? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. We begin with Dan Moulthrop. He's a reporter and local host for member station WCPN and joins us from their studios in Cleveland, Ohio. Nice of you to take the time to be with us today.
Neil, hi. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Officials there in Cleveland held a news conference earlier today. Do we learn anything new?
Not exactly, Neil. The main news there is that the school's officials, school CEO Eugene Sanders, will issue a report, a new plan for school safety tomorrow by noon. He's got a bit of a deadline there that he's facing. The indication there is that the plan that was in place wasn't sufficient, that for some reason there were some significant holes, although nobody is really, none of the officials from City Hall or from the municipal school district are sort of identifying yet what those holes are.
We heard at various points yesterday that the school went into what they called code blue. What's code blue?
Code blue, as I understand it, and I'm not exactly familiar with what all the drills are, but code blue appears to mean there's some sort of a shooting incident, some sort of a gunman, that sort of a thing. A lot of schools in the region, across the nation now, don't just do fire drills. You know, they do somebody's got a gun drills.
Yeah. What do we know now about Asa Kuhn?
He was a pretty troubled kid, although some of the reports of how troubled he was were a bit overblown to begin with. He had a record with county juvenile justice officials. He'd been arrested in 2006 on a domestic violence charge. What that actually was, it sounds kind of worse and more official than what it was that he hit his mother while he and his twin sister were fighting. And his mother called the police, and they came and broke it up. He wound up actually serving some time in a juvenile detention facility. He was then on probation. He was sentenced to some anger management, and he was off probation by November of 2006. It had been almost 11 months or so since he had been on probation.
But he was not a student at this school.
He was a student at the school.
Oh,
he'd
was.
Been suspended. He was, in fact, a student at the school. He'd been suspended earlier in the week because of a fight. And but despite the fact that he was suspended, he was able to walk right back into the school with a duffel bag and two guns, three tactical folding knives, and a change of clothes. He apparently walked right past where a security guard is usually posted in the lower levels of the same building where that's not a school, up into the school area, into a bathroom where a student actually saw him loading a weapon. And then he began his rampage.
And did that student who saw him loading a weapon, is that where the first alarm went out?
Actually, it's hard to say. That student spoke to one of our producers yesterday, and he told her that he then went back to his classroom, and they were joking around in his classroom, and he sort of forgot about what he had seen. But exactly. It's hard to believe. In an Associated Press report that's posted on NPR.org right now, the same student is quoted from his appearance on Good Morning America or one of the other morning news programs, saying that he went back and told the teacher, and they tried to tell the principal, but the principal was busy. It's pretty clear that this kid, if he did indeed see this, it's pretty clear that he may not be a reliable witness, and police officials have said they're questioning his account of what happened.
I see. From your description, you said the Asa Kuhn walked past a spot where a security guard normally is, but obviously not there all the time. And if he walked in with a duffel bag with all that stuff in it that you describe, clearly there was no metal detector.
There was no metal detector, and that security guard in the building, the Success Tech Academy, was started in 2002, I believe, funded by grants from the Gates Foundation and their Small Schools Initiative. This was supposed to be a school, and indeed for many students it was a school that held a great deal of promise. It was an opportunity to get out of the larger comprehensive high schools where you're just sort of another number for a lot of kids into a place where they could get more individualized attention and see being classrooms with only 15 other students. And when it was opened, there was a security guard assigned to the school who roamed the hallways, who knew the kids by their names. That security guard had been reassigned in recent years, and parents had complained about the fact that there was no real security. The security guard who was downstairs is assigned to the administrative offices that are not part of the school, but actually district administrative offices. That security guard doesn't know much about the school at all, or the students, or who's suspended or who's not. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really clear if there was any interaction with that security guard, if that security guard was there. If he was there, he didn't say anything to the student.
One thing we have learned about previous cases going back to Columbine and further back is that motives can take a long time before we truly understand what the motives are. But what do we know at this point about Asa Kuhn's motive?
He wasn't well. We know that much. We know that he had been on antidepressant medications as well as another medication that's often used to treat the side effects of Ritalin. So he may have been diagnosed with a learning disability. Reports suggest, and this is sort of from kids who were trying to explain to press yesterday, and very little of this has been confirmed, that there was an argument in school earlier this week about the existence of God. And Asa Kuhn had said he doesn't believe in God, but made a big deal out of this. A fight eventually spilled out into spilled outside the school, and that's what led to his suspension. And there's some thought that this was sort of retribution for the suspension and the argument before.
Dan Moulthrop, we know you're busy. Thanks so much for your time today.
You're very welcome, Neil. Thanks so much for having me.
Dan Moulthrop, reporter and local host for member station WCPN, and he joined us from their studios in Cleveland, Ohio. When this kind of shooting happens, it raises questions about how schools can prepare, and it's often William Lasseter who's called in to help school districts plan for the unthinkable. He's the manager of the Center for the Prevention of School Violence, and he joins us now by phone from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. William Lasseter, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you.
And if you could provide any clarification, we heard that the principal in Cleveland called that code blue once the shooter was spotted. What kind of plans do schools set up in this sort of event?
Well, what schools have been really doing since Columbine is a technique that we call rapid deployment with lockdown. And rapid deployment is the technique that law enforcement's actually using, and lockdown is the technique that the schools themselves are using. Let's look at the lockdown procedure first. Lockdown is really getting kids behind a locked door, getting them behind a secure location, and then holding in that location until the shooting has ended. And why that technique seems to work is because active shooters have a mentality that they want to go into a school and hurt individuals as quickly as they possibly can. And a lot of times when you lock yourself behind a door, it gives you that added protection, and the shooter will quickly get frustrated and try to move on to another location. So the lockdown procedure is actually working pretty well. A lot of schools that you don't hear about because the shooting was not successful have used lockdown and have found that it has worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
The rapid deployment technique is the technique that law enforcement's using, and that's where law enforcement used to wait when they had an incident like this until the SWAT team arrived, and they would go in and try to stop the individual at that point. And at Columbine, they did that very thing, and it took them 45 minutes just to get the SWAT team to the school. And the incident itself only actually lasted 20 minutes. So what law enforcement learned from that was that we need to get law enforcement into the building to change the dynamics of the situation, because nobody on the school campus is actually supposed to have a gun. So the only person that has one is that active shooter themselves. So law enforcement getting in there as quickly as possibly they can, the first patrol officer on campus going in and trying to stop that individual is what we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Again, there is a great deal we do not know about what happened at that school in Cleveland yesterday, but on the basis of the what we have heard, do you think that today's call for the school board to come up with a new emergency plan by noon tomorrow, do you think that's justified?
Well, I think it's always a good idea after you have an incident like this to go back and look at what were the lessons learned and what can we do to improve our plan. you know, a couple of things that I've noticed just from what I've heard, and it'd be more telling tomorrow once we see the full report, but I think one of the things that we've really been pushing schools to do is use plain English. And what I mean by that, if you want the kids and the staff to go to lockdown, you say go to lockdown. Don't use a code, because people might get confused about what that really is. They might think it's a drill. Let's just use plain English. Go to lockdown. There's an active shooter on campus.
And drills, as we heard from Dan Moulthrop, schools not just in Cleveland but around the country don't have just fire drills anymore, but there's a shooter in the building drills. Are they useful?
They're very useful, because schools can learn from those lockdown drills and learn where their weaknesses lie. For example, I did a lockdown drill just earlier this week with a school, and 10 teachers couldn't lock their doors because they didn't have keys to the doors. Well, it's very essential in lockdown, obviously, to be able to lock your door. That was a simple thing that they could remedy really quickly at that school, but they would have not realized it if they didn't have the drill itself. And the other point I would point out is that, you know, we've been doing fire drills since the 1950s in the United States. And the reason why we did that was there was a major school fire where a number of students died. Since we've done those fire drills in the United States, no kids have actually died in a school. Well, since we started doing lockdown drills, we can't promise that every child's going to live through a school shooting, but we can say that the chances are going to be much better if they do these drills. Mm-hmm. And last year in the United States, over almost 40 kids in the United States died in a school shooting. So I think it's necessary for us to take those steps.
We're talking with William Lassiter, who helps schools prepare for and prevent violence, and we're talking about the lessons learned in the wake of yesterday's shooting at the school in Cleveland and all those other regrettable and tragic incidents that we've heard about. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get a caller on the line, and this is Calypso. Calypso's with us from Oklahoma City.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a teacher, and I've been through the lockdown simulations several times in several different situations, and my husband's a principal, and I really think the key to this is for students not to know what the lockdown procedure is. We practice the drill on professional development days so that the students don't know, you know, how do we handle a situation.
Why is it important that the students not know the procedures?
Well, if they know the procedure, then they're going to know how to get into the building when we are in lockdown.
Ah.
They're going to know, you know, how to get in the classrooms and what we're going to do.
And I wondered about some of the other points that William Lassiter was mentioning. When there's a drill, does it say lockdown, lockdown, or is it code pink or code blue?
We actually call it a lockdown drill.
Lockdown.
We get on the principal gets on the intercom, and we're only allowed to listen to the principal unless it's even in law enforcement. If they came in and said we have a lockdown drill, we're not supposed to listen to them. We're only supposed to listen to our principal.
I see. William Lassiter, what do you think? Should the drills be held without the students there?
I think, number one, you got to look at age appropriateness. Obviously, with kindergartners, you got to be very careful, you know, what you're exposing them to. But even with the high schoolers, like the teacher saying, it's important that some of the techniques and some of the procedures that are going to be used, that students aren't exposed to all of that, because we don't want the intruder or the person that's committing the crime to know everything. But at the same time, we do need to train students on what they're supposed to do. When you have a fire drill, we tell students that they're supposed to go out in an orderly fashion, and they're supposed to do these certain things as with their class. So during a lockdown, the kids need to know what they're supposed to do and insist assist the teacher in getting those things done. So it's important that we teach them some things, but we don't need to tell them everything.
Mm. Calypso, do you think after this training that your school is ready?
I think if a student wanted to come into our building with a gun, that could happen. I think that there's no way for us, unless the students come to school naked, for us to keep them safe completely. But, you know, I'm willing to take that risk because, we have 1,600 students in my school. There's no way to keep everybody out. But I think if we're prepared, we can definitely eliminate how bad the situation could be.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much. And we do have to remind ourselves that as we run through the litany of these incidents in Paducah and Columbine and yesterday, of course, in Cleveland, these are very, very rare. So this is not something that happens every day. One of the reasons, I guess, we're talking about it. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Tim. Tim's calling us from Boston.
Hi. I guess I'm on the complete opposite side of the fence as the last caller. I'm a recent high school graduate in college now. Went to a very small private school where we never ran drills for shooter in the building or anything like that. But I also went to a K-12 school. We were all in the same building. And for almost a solid 2 weeks, we had a lower-level student who would place a note in the bathroom saying that there's a bomb in the building, it's going to blow up at 11:50 today, and for 2 weeks, we got to go home at 11:45. And it got to the point where during Wednesday of the second week, I just kept my keys in the car, because I knew at 11:15 I'd be walking out of the building and going home.
William Lasseter, I guess in some cases the precautions can go a little far.
Yeah, and I think it's important. What we train schools on is what we call threat assessment, and that's really looking at whether when a threat is made on a school campus, for example, a bomb threat or a student saying, I'm going to come to school and shoot a bunch of students, how do you determine the legitimacy of that threat, and what steps should that school take in place? And we really give them a three-stage process that they can go through to determine the legitimacy and what they should do to the child if they do catch who made those threats. And it sounds like in that situation, you know, the student was really dominating the procedures of the school, and you don't want that to occur, but at the same time, you have to put yourself in that administrator's shoes and say, well, what if I didn't call school that day and there really was a bomb on the school campus? What, you know, the liability of that is tremendous.
Yeah, much, of course, there would be obviously people killed too, much beyond the liability question.
Exactly.
Thanks very much for the call, Tim.
Thank you.
All right. And William Lasseter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
William Lasseter, manager of the Center for the Prevention of School Violence. He joined us on the phone from Winston-Salem in North Carolina. Stay tuned to NPR News for the latest on the shooting in Cleveland throughout the day and later today on All Things Considered. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.